Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
You'd normally find me introducing a full-on Science Weekly podcast right now, but because it's nearing summer, we're actually on a break. We'll be back properly on July the 6th, and between now and then, we're going to bring you a different item or interview every week, a taster of the kinds of things we do on the podcast. This week, we've got Martin Rees. He's one of the world's leading authorities on cosmology. He's Astronomer Royal and also President of the Royal Society. So when I got a chance to speak with him recently at the Hay Festival, I jumped at it. Here he is talking about our world in 2050, whether or not humans have the power to tackle climate change, and if we'll ever find aliens.
Well, there's some things we've been fairly confident about, in particular that the world will have more people in it, barring catastrophe, than it has today. The best estimates of the world population in 2050 are about 9 billion, and each of those people are going to be using more resources and probably eating more food than people are today, and so this large population is going to place pressures on the world's environment and water resources and energy resources. And one key question, of course, is what the population will do after 2050. It's going to be bad news if it continues to rise, but one hopes it will have turned around by then.
Now, you reckon that there's going to be something like 9 billion people. How are we going to feed these people?
Well, it may need a second green revolution, rather like the first one, without which we couldn't feed the present world population. But there's going to be a special difficulty because climate change, of course, is changing global weather patterns, and this may have some effects which are negative, particularly in Africa. And Africa is a special concern because that's the one country where the population is still growing very fast. Many other parts of the world have reached a situation when the average woman is having less than one female child, so the birth rate's below replacement level. The population in those countries will still grow for a bit because the young outnumber the old. But in Africa, the birth rate is still very high, and so there'll be at least a billion more people in Africa in the year 2050 than there are today. And one remarkable figure is that in 1950, Europe had three times Africa's population, whereas in 2050, Africa will have three times Europe's population. That indicates the tremendous shift in the balance between different parts of the world.
2050, in many people's minds, raises the idea of climate change targets. We talk about how we have to cut emissions by a certain time, and 2050 seems to be far enough away for us to not have to worry about them too much. But do you think that we're going to have any sort of handle on these issues by then?
Well, G8 and the EU and the UK government have all recommended policies based on trying to cut global CO2 emissions by a factor of 2 by 2050. And this requires a very severe percentage cut in countries that are the main emitters now. For instance, we in the UK would have to cut by 80% to get down to that level. And that, of course, is a big challenge, and I think we'll need technological advances beyond the kind of green energy sources we have at the moment. And also, of course, to be of any use, it's got to be broadly international, because we in this country only produce about 2% of the world's emissions. And so the big challenge is not only to have rapid technological development of more efficient and cheaper kinds of clean energy and to use existing energy more efficiently, but also to develop a equitable international agreement that really sticks over that long period.
Are you quite confident about technology as a way to save us from climate change?
Well, I certainly think that if there was an adequate commitment, then there would be no problem deriving energy from clean renewable sources. One of the problems, though, has been that the level of R&D on energy has been disproportionately low. It ought to be at least on the level of health and medical R&D, and it's far, far lower than that. I think one needs to have an emphasis on R&D in the energy sector, equivalent to the Apollo program in the US in the 1960s and the Manhattan Project. And it's gratifying that President Obama has stated that energy would be the centerpiece of his plan to expand the proportion of the US budget spent on R&D.
If you could decide on a Manhattan or Apollo project for clean energy, what would it be?
Well, I think you advance on a broad front, but I think in the medium term we have to see if carbon capture and storage can be made to work economically, because coal-fired power stations now being planned will have a lifetime of 40 years. and so we need to be able to extract the carbon dioxide from them before the end of their lifetime. Otherwise, the CO2 is going to rise to a level that some climate scientists think may be dangerous. But I think, looking further ahead, that we need to develop efficient battery technology, second and third generation biofuels, and also solar collectors of various kinds. My favourite long-term solution for Europe would be solar energy collected in the Sahara and spread around Europe via a unified DC smart grid. That's the kind of vast infrastructure project which I believe Europe should prioritise.
Now, you seem quite optimistic about that, but you weren't very optimistic about the international government's commitment to spend up to 2% of GDP on climate change solutions, as Nicholas Stern has suggested. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, of course, what Nicholas Stern has pointed out is that it's only fair that the countries of Europe and the US should subsidise the transition to clean energy in countries like India and China, which are not responsible for much of the current CO2 production. And therefore, there needs to be, in effect, some kind of massive transfer. I hope there is some way of doing this via a carbon cap and trade system. But although we're talking about only 1% or 2% of the GNP of the West, which may not seem very much to provide, to put it in perspective, I think it's slightly discouraging to realise that there is a UN target of 0.7% of GNP to be spent on overseas aid. And essentially no country has met that target. Most countries are far below it, even though the humanitarian imperative is far stronger and far more immediate than the cause of climate change. And therefore, that comparison leads me to be pessimistic about the political will to make the necessary transfers from the already developed to the developing world.
Is there anything you can see that will change that political will?
Well, of course, as time goes on, and the effects of climate change become more apparent, then the will may grow. But I think we've got to look at this positively and realise that there is an opportunity for the countries, particularly of Europe, to take a lead in developing the kind of clean energy technology which the whole world is going to need. So I would see that the development of a new energy infrastructure is something which is important for Europe, just as the development of railways was in the second half of the 19th century. It's a project on the same sort of scale, but it will have the comparable payoff in the long run.
You also talked about coming at climate change from the other side, so geoengineering. Now, whilst this is a backup plan, in your words, do we need to be considering it?
Well, I think many ideas for geoengineering are rather flaky, and I certainly think it's worthwhile exploring them in more detail, and the Royal Society is in fact currently doing a study of some of these, because I think one needs to know what is completely crazy and what is a feasible option. Although, of course, if geoengineering became possible, it would lead to all kinds of political disputes, even more acute than those which climate change involves anyway.
Would you hazard a guess that by 2050, your vision of 2050, there might be one or two of these schemes up and running?
Well, I think it would be feasible to have massive solar energy collection in the Sahara for Europe and in other sunny desert areas of the world. It may also be that fusion power is feasible by that time. I think those are the most optimistic prospects I have in mind. But of course, for those to work, we need to have a grid for distribution. We also need to have ways of storing energy by new battery technology, etc. And I think if we in this country were to proclaim this as an important national goal, it would give us the chance of having a head start in these new technologies, and also would have the bonus of being just the thing needed to encourage young people to embark on learning science and scientific careers, because it combines intellectual challenge with an idealistic aim.
Let's move off planet now, somewhere perhaps closer to your heart as a cosmologist. You have a vision also that by 2050, or maybe a bit beyond, that the whole of the solar system would be explored by a flotilla of satellites. We have a few satellites already up, Herschel and Planck and Kepler. Mm-hmm. These are doing very exciting things about the structure of the universe and also how the universe expanded after the Big Bang. What kinds of other parts of the solar system would you explore if you had the choice?
Well, I think by 2050 it would be reasonable to imagine that a whole lot of robotic craft have really been essentially everywhere in the solar system and mapped it out, because I think costs will come down. Miniaturization allows sophisticated spacecraft to be very small and consume very little power. So I have every hope that there will be a real detailed mapping of all the solar system by then. There may be larger scale projects where fabricators, robotically controlled, can actually make quite big things away from the Earth using resources out there rather than taking everything from the Earth. So I'm optimistic about that, as also I am about the growing use of space for technological purposes. Of course, we depend on space already for communications, weather forecasting, GPS, etc., and that dependence is going to grow.
You mentioned that deep down, as a practical person, you weren't keen on humans going into space. And you said this before, but then you also said something I thought quite surprising, that actually, personally speaking, you think it's a great adventure.
I think it is. And I think it is more likely to be feasible if manned spaceflight is done by the kind of people prepared to take very high risks. Because the problem with NASA's program is that the American public and the American politicians are not prepared to tolerate substantial risks. The shuttle has crashed twice in 120 launches. That's less than a 2% failure rate. But of course, each of those failures was a real trauma. The astronauts are prepared to take higher risks themselves. And I therefore think that a more likely scenario is that, given that going into space for humans is an adventure rather than having a practical goal, it'll be done in a cut-price way, perhaps privately funded, by people prepared to take high risks and even have one-way tickets. And I think a program costing, say, $10 billion, privately funded, would be feasible. I mean, obviously, there are individuals in the world who could pay for that, but also another calibration is the cost of the McLaren and Formula One racing teams, which until the recent change in regulations were $300 or $400 million per year, mainly raised through sponsorship. And so if you calibrate from that, then the idea of getting sponsorship for a program to go to Mars for an 11-figure sum is not crazy.
Britain's just got its first astronaut through the ESA astronaut corps, Timothy Peake. Do you think that people like him will inspire people to get into science, children to get into science?
Certainly there are many people who are inspired by that prospect, and I think it's very good that the UK is playing a role in a possible European programme. I mean, again, I'm slightly ambivalent about the priority that Europe should give to manned spaceflight, because our budget is far smaller than NASA's, and we have to decide whether we spend our smaller budget mainly on unmanned, which would allow us to actually do a better job than NASA in the unmanned programme, or whether we spend some of it on a manned programme, possibly jointly with the US.
You mentioned that if people do go back into space, especially NASA has its moon plans at the moment, and then eventually Mars, that actually there might be Chinese, first of all.
Well, I think China has the sort of dirigiste government and the will and the technology to send people to the moon within 10 years, whereas I don't think there's any reason why the Americans would prioritise it. You know, been there, done that, why do it again? The Chinese may decide they didn't want to do it, but if they wanted to, they could.
As a cosmologist, then, for you, clearly robotics, spacecraft of the future, what are the missions, the robotic missions, or that are either in planning or that you think would be great to have in planning that could answer some of the questions you want answered?
Well, I think we want to have probes of all our solar system to understand it better. This year has been a good year for advancing our potential understanding of the wider universe with the launch of three important spacecraft: Kepler to look for Earth-like planets around other stars, Herschel to look for stars forming early in the history of the universe in the infrared, and the Planck spacecraft to study the immediate aftermath of the Big Bang in greater detail than before by looking at the background radiation. So those are all important projects, and two of them are major European projects, which is excellent. Looking further ahead, I think we would like to have further exploration of Mars. We'd like to have a still bigger telescope in space of a kind that might be able to directly image planets and also very, very distant galaxies, a follow-on from the Hubble Space Telescope. But also, I think we can look forward to a new generation of giant ground-based telescopes. And this is an area where Europe can perhaps get a world lead if it continues with plans to build a telescope with a 30 or 40 metre diameter mirror.
One of the tantalising things about those telescopes is that they might be able to image Earth-like planets. Mm-hmm. What are the chances of finding signs of life on those planets?
Well, it's hard to lay reliable odds because biology is a harder subject than astronomy, and we don't really understand how life got started on Earth. We understand how from simple life our biosphere has evolved, our Darwinian selection processes, but we don't understand how life got started here. And until we understand that, we can't lay firm odds on whether it would start elsewhere, nor have any firm view on where best to look for it. But I would hope that we will understand more about the origins of life on Earth within the next 20 years, and that will firm up our views on how likely it is elsewhere. In our solar system, there are places where there could conceivably be some basic forms of life, even on Mars or Europa or Titan, but no one expects anything other than freeze-dried bacteria or something like that anywhere in our solar system. But of course, if one could show that life had started independently elsewhere in our solar system, that would be very important, because if it had evolved twice within one solar system, that would show that it evolved almost everywhere given the right conditions, and at least simple life would be widespread in the universe.
If you're a betting man, would you say that life does exist somewhere in the many multiverses that we might exist in?
Well, I think if we talk about a multiverse, of course, it's a separate story where you have a whole range of physical laws, then certainly life must exist in lots of them. But if we talk about the part of the universe we can observe, I think my betting odds would be that some forms of life would exist. As to whether any intelligent life with an intelligence we could recognise exists, then that, of course, is not anything we've been confident about, but it's such a fascinating question that I'm in favour of searches by all possible techniques.
Something I thought, actually, after your lecture was, someone asked you a question at the end about how did the Big Bang start? Mm-hmm. And you said that we know pretty much until a few seconds or microseconds after the Big Bang what's happened. Before that, we haven't got the experiments to work out what's happened. Do you think that experiments like the Large Hadron Collider are as exciting to you as a cosmologist as they are to particle physicists hunting for the Higgs boson?
Well, the reason that we can't be too confident about the very, very early stages of the Big Bang is that the conditions then were outside the range, beyond the range of any current laboratory experiment. And, of course, the LHC, by extending that range, is going to give us extra clues to what happened in the early phases. It might also give us clues as to the new kind of particles that might be formed at those high energies, and those particles might be important for the dark matter, which is one of the key mysteries in our subject. But if you want to understand the very, very beginning of the universe, we will need to go beyond the LHC to have a sort of unified theory which combines Einstein's gravity with the quantum theory. At the moment, we have a fairly good understanding of the micro world, of the quantum, and we have a fairly good understanding, due mainly to Einstein, of gravity and the large-scale behaviour of space and time. But what we don't have is a theory combining those two. And that doesn't matter in most of astronomy or the everyday world, because quantum theory is important in the micro world, but it's not important for the orbits of planets. The fuzziness due to quantum effect is unimportant on the astronomical scale, and likewise gravity is unimportant on the scale of atoms, because gravity is a very weak force except when planets are involved. But if we are trying to understand the very beginning of the universe, when, as it were, the whole universe is squeezed the size of an atom, then clearly we need to take account of both gravity and particle physics, and we don't have a theory which does that. People are exploring theories like superstrings, which may be the answer. These are very difficult. It's not clear whether they're on the right lines, but it's also clear that any such theory is going to force us to jettison many common sense ideas, the idea that time just ticks away and space has three dimensions. So just as quantum mechanics was sort of spooky and counterintuitive because it was far away from the everyday experience which our brains evolved on the African savannah to cope with, so understanding the early stages of the Big Bang will be even further from everyday experience and therefore probably even more counterintuitive, even harder for our minds to grasp.
Is there any reason that why our minds will be able to grasp it? You made quite a nice analogy with quantum mechanics and chimpanzees in your lecture, where you said that there's no way that a chimpanzee would understand quantum mechanics or it has the brain to do that. Do we have the brain to understand the unified theory?
Well, we may not. And I think we have to accept that there are some things, and consciousness is another deep mystery, where we may never get a complete understanding. But that, of course, leads to another question, which is, are human brains the culmination of evolution? And, of course, the answer to that is no, for two reasons. The first reason is that, of course, as many Californian futurologists say, and they're not always crazy, computers may eventually surpass human intelligence in important ways, not just the ways they can now, and so they may be able to take things further. And of course we also know that the time lying ahead for the Earth is about as long as the time that's elapsed up till now, and so there's no reason to think that Darwinian biological evolution is anywhere near its end, and so the post-human era beckons and might allow creatures with greater intellectual powers to develop. But of course, we still try as hard as we can, because clearly we can go a great deal further by persevering along the lines of the last century's research.
That was Martin Rees, cosmologist extraordinaire and president of the Royal Society. Science Weekly will be back in full on July the 6th, but until then, you can follow all the latest science news on our website. That's at guardian.co.uk/science. Or on Twitter, just look for Guardian Science. So until next week, it's goodbye. This show is produced by Pascal Wise. I'm Alok Jha.